You're listening to the Daily, Daily Caller podcast on iTunes and thedailycaller.com. Alrighty, welcome to the Daily, Daily Caller podcast. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. So much to get to. So little time. Actually, I got all the time in the world, except for the fact that I have to get to bed so that I can pack boxes in the morning. If you think that your life is crap, take my life and feel better about yours. We are scheduled to move Saturday in Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C. That means that, of course, the hurricane is supposed to hit right about then. So we'll see if that actually happens. Thankfully, we still have 2 weeks in our current place before we have to vacate these premises. So if it gets postponed, it won't be the end of the world. Pro tip for anybody ever thinking about moving, first, don't. Secondly, make sure you build in a buffer. Have a little bit of overlap. Think of it as the reverse of what you do when you get a new job. Whenever I've gotten a new job, I always try and build in a week off between jobs because I like time off from jobs. So, you know, I can start on the first, and or I can my last day will be on the first, and I'll start on the 8th, something like that. My math was going to be all screwed up if I went the other way. So this is the pro tip for moving. First of all, don't. We just need a bigger house because we got a second kid on the way, and c'est la vie. And once it's over, I'm sure I'll like it much more than I do now. Although I'm living in a world made of cardboard at the moment. I'm 6'5" and I'm looking at boxes piled up as high as I can stack them. Not really that high, but because I can touch the ceiling, but pretty damn high. And then we got the hurricane rolling up the East Coast, allegedly. I'm not one of these alarmists. I think that the hurricane coverage definitely gets overhyped. Hurricanes happen. It's hurricane season, and it's called hurricane season for a reason, just like Tornado Alley is called Tornado Alley for a reason, etc., etc. But the media, especially at times of slow news days, and yesterday was kind of a slow news day, they love these sorts of stories because it's the people who are going through it are going to tune into the news. Here's a little inside scoop into how the media works. The people who are going through it are going to turn into the news because they want to know the latest information. So they've already got a larger audience in that region than they otherwise would get. And the rest of the country loves natural disasters. They feel empathy for the people going through it, and they want to know what's going on as well. So while it seems like an incredibly boring weather event, which it ultimately is, and it could still turn north and not do any damage to anything, not even hit the East Coast. It is a ratings boon to the media, so they go crazy for this. You never understood, you never wondered why, like, Matt Drudge puts a hurricane at the top story whenever there's a hurricane, no matter where it is, out in the ocean, far away from landfall, and how many of them turn out to be duds? I don't know if Florence is going to end up being a dud or not, but I do know that on Monday, you shouldn't go wall-to-wall coverage on something that, if everything goes according to the predictions now, and remember, these are predictions from, you know, the weather people who don't really ever get it right. If all goes well, it'll start impacting the East Coast on Thursday. So why so much hype ahead of time outside of the region? The region has to be evacuated. I get that. It's because of ratings. It's because of clicks. It's because people have a morbid curiosity about awful things that they aren't going through, but other people could be going through. That's why you get it. I perhaps am in denial about the move. Maybe, but I just really want to get out of these damn boxes. So my professional advice to anybody who's considering moving, don't. And if you do, build yourself in a buffer. I've done this before. I've made the mistake, had to move on rainy days where the U-Haul is rented, the lease is up, and you got to go on the 31st, and that's all she wrote. You got to get everything out there soaked. So thankfully, we have a bit of a buffer. Hopefully, we won't have to use it because the internet is being shut off here. The cable is being shut off here and being turned on the next day at the new house. Hopefully that works out, fingers crossed. We shall see. There is a lot of stuff I want to get to today. Little quick hits, because it was kind of a slow news day. Most people in the podcasting business won't bother telling you that it was a slow news day or on radio or on TV. They'll just do a whole bunch of stories that aren't really big national stories and hope you don't notice. But I'm not going to lie to you. So I didn't want to talk about this, but we are going to get into tennis. I didn't want to talk about this because I don't care about tennis. I don't think I've ever really cared about tennis, men's or women's tennis. But there's a controversy brewing, and it's a bigger sort of look into society as a whole and what we've become as a society and how sad we've become as a society. So I will touch a little bit about that. There's a lot of other things I want to get to. But first, I got to tell you about our wonderful sponsors, the American Conservative Union. And look, I used to be a health policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. My specialty was prescription drugs. It was a lot of work. It was a pain, but you learned about how these important life-saving and life-changing and life-bettering drugs come to market. They come to market through years of research, trials, errors, false starts, and hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars. Well, did you know that the American patients, American citizens, are subsidizing health care in foreign countries? That's right. Countries with socialized health care force American patients to subsidize the rest of the world. Their governments say you can't sell in our country unless you sell at a price we approve of. There's only one gatekeeper. There's not a whole bunch of insurance companies to negotiate with, and some will take it and some won't. There's one gatekeeper to the entire population, and that's the government. Who are you going to appeal to in those countries? The government says no. The government says we're going to steal your patent if you don't give us the price we want. Well, that price that they want many times is cheaper than the market price and cheaper than the cost needed to recoup the cost of developing the drugs. Here's how it works. Americans produce life-saving drugs and life-changing new medicines, improving lives forever. We're the world leader in that. Most of the new drugs that are in development that have come to the market come from the United States. That's not by accident. It's because of our freedoms and our liberties. And these foreign governments say, we're not going to pay. We'll just steal your patent if you don't agree to it. Well, they have to make up that money somewhere. If you're not getting the market price from a foreign country, you got to charge a little bit more in the places that you are able to negotiate with individual companies and raise that price. That's us. We have the freedom here, and we're getting screwed by countries that don't have freedom. For a long time, politicians whined and complained about this, but they didn't really do all that much. They let these free riders ride. Well, President Trump is fighting to end this free riding in the prescription drug market, and it's about damn time. You can find out all about it. Just go to conservative.org. That is conservative.org. It may not impact your life right now, but someday, trust me, it will, and it's important. All right, I want to get into this. I talked a little bit about the hurricane. I don't want to talk any more about the hurricane, but I do want to, before we get into the more serious things and the more ridiculous things, there is, I don't know if you, what you did with your Sunday night. I assume it was more productive than mine, because part of mine, particularly the 10 o'clock to 11, 11 o'clock hour, was spent watching the Miss America pageant. And it turns out I was one of the few people watching the Miss America pageant. I just happened to be flipping around and saw that it was on. My wife loves those things. She produces morning radio in D.C. and she watches all this crap because she needs to know what's going on in the world. In this pop culture stuff, her hosts go to bed way early. They don't pay attention to this stuff. So she has to. And she loves to watch the Q&A. We watched the Q&A, and one of the, I think it was the one that actually won. Her question was being, I think if it was Miss New York, she's won. The question was, how has being a New Yorker prepared you to be Miss America? And her answer was like, I've had to move 5 times and I'm sitting here in a pile of boxes. And I'm like, really? Because I could be Miss America. I've moved a bunch of times in my life. But I just thought it was really funny. Dealing with subletting in New York City is really tough, and moving is really tough because things are expensive. And I'm like, hell, I am Miss America. I should be Miss America. Where's my scholarship money? I'm still cutting checks for my student loans. But it turns out that I was one of the few. The wife and I were one of the few people watching the Miss America pageant. Ratings were down 36%. And in the key demo, which is generally 18 to 49 or something like that, those are the only people advertisers care about. It's kind of funny that you care about 18-year-olds when they're the ones, they don't have any damn money. They didn't watch. The numbers in the demo were down 19% overall. Huge, I'm sorry, 36% down in the demo, 19% overall. Huge drops. Massive cratering. Now, this was the first year that Gretchen Carlson was the head of the Miss America pageant, and she did away with the swimsuit competition, and she did away with the beauty pageant aspect of the beauty pageant, which is asinine, which is insane, which is just another leftist assault on traditions in this country. I don't care if you want to change traditions or you want to start your own, but some things don't need to be changed right away because of the political whims of the moment. Most people reject these sort of forced changes based on the political whims of the moment. A lot of opposition to gay marriage, for example, was done not because anybody was homophobic, although you would never know that to listen to a leftist talk about it, but because they didn't like the way it went about. There was no vote. There was no discussion. There was no debate. There was a decree by the mayor of San Francisco and a decree by the Supreme Court of Massachusetts. That's how it started. No referendums came around. It was all, we're going to court, we're going to sue, we're going to force this to happen. In democracies and republics, people tend to resist things that way. That was, there are a lot of things in this country's history that have been sort of forced and foisted upon them, on the people, without actually taking the temperature of the people, without actually involving the people in that discussion, which is the antithesis of what this country is supposed to be. Civil rights legislation was passed by the congressional representatives of the people and signed by the president. That's the way it should have been done. It might have been a little bit of a harder slog. It might have taken a little bit longer, but I don't know that it would have, quite honestly, because nobody bothered to try. And the Miss America pageant is certainly not the gay marriage issue, but it is this sort of the PC moment is now. Very PC, very small part of the population, but big outweighted influence because corporations and organizations live in fear of the liberal mob being woken up to be angry at them. They all seem to think that, oh my gosh, if we piss off the liberal mob, we will lose all of our customers, which isn't really the case. It's not the case. Most people don't care. And most people will forget. And you might actually, if you stood up for something on principle like individual freedom, you might actually, I don't know, win more customers, something crazy like that. But the tanking of the Miss America pageant was a self-inflicted wound. And we see so many corporations do this on a regular basis, these self-inflicted wounds, these stupidities, these woke actions done in the name of political correctness and progress. What progress? Miss America is a beauty pageant that awards scholarship money to remove the looks aspect of it. It's not just looks. It's not just whether or not somebody has a pretty face. They have to be fit. They have to be put together. They have to be poised. They have to be intelligent. It is what any human being, the attributes, any human being would build a person like this with these attributes if they had access to the box of parts to make a human being. But to remove some of that is ridiculous. And quite frankly, the appeal, the sex appeal of the bathing suit contest. To remove that in the name of political correctness is why I think that and the surrounding negative press that came with it and the self-righteousness with which it was promoted is why people stayed away from this thing. Who gives a damn about a scholarship program? Turns out, not that many people. Another stupid move. This is ridiculous. I'm going to tie these two things together. Now, we're going to wait for a second. We're going to get to the Serena Williams thing in a second. But first, I want to talk about the big news out of CBS. Les Moonves. He's probably somebody you've barely ever heard of. His wife is Julie Chen. If you watch CBS, I don't watch CBS. I think CBS is mostly from, you know, people my parents' age. He is the CEO. He's been CEO for about 15, 17 years, something like that. Incredibly powerful, incredibly wealthy, especially CBS is the number one network in the world right now, or in the country right now, at least. So he's made a ton of money. Apparently, on his climb up the ladder, he was looking up some skirts along the way. There are a lot of allegations against him from women who say that he sexually harassed them, sexually assaulted them, pressured them into sex, so on and so forth. Now, these rumors had been circulating for some time, and Ronan Farrow came out with a new report just the other day detailing six new accusers, three of which put their names to it, who said that Les Moonves pressured them into sex or groped them, grabbed them, made comments, impacted their careers, such and such. One woman, I believe, at least one woman, maybe two, said that he forced them to perform oral sex on him. Sounds like a hell of a guy, doesn't he? He's a big-time lib, of course, because all these guys are liberal hypocrites. Well, in his resignation and in his defense, Moonves said that that some of the women he had consensual sexual relations with. He denied all the allegations and said that some of the women he had consensual sexual relations with, which to my mind isn't the best defense to charges like this. No, they wanted it. Not really a good thing. Well, anyway, he resigned. The board sort of invited him to leave, the board over at CBS, but not before negotiating. They'd been under negotiations for some time to get him to leave CBS. Now, when you or I get fired from a job, there might be a little bit of severance pay at the end of it, but mostly we're told don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. Get your stuff. You've got 5 minutes. Let's go. Come on. Get out of here. When somebody at the level of Les Moonves does, they pack up a nice, sweet, golden parachute for him. Now, according to published reports, I don't know if these numbers are real. I don't know how these numbers could feel real to anybody. Les Moonves' golden parachute could be upwards of $120 million. Now, to cover his own butt as he walks out the door, he and CBS, because they need to cover their butt too, because there's all kinds of indications that they may have known about this stuff for a while, and they've had their own problems with Charlie Rose, that they've agreed that $20 million of that will go to organizations supporting the Me Too movement, which is, I don't know, it seems like the height of hypocrisy, the height of arrogance, and just a PR gimmick to me. You're just on the way out the door. Here's $20 million. I'm taking $100 million, but here's $20 million. Now shut up and don't protest me at the next Clinton fundraiser at the Hamptons. It's essentially what they're doing. It'll work because Les Moonves is on the team. He supports all the right causes. Oh, maybe some people will turn up. He'll probably have a rough 6 months or so. But after that, all will be forgiven. He'll be able to re-enter polite society because he thinks right. He's on the left side of the aisle, and that's good enough for everybody. Honestly, it's really sad and pathetic. Either Me Too means something or it doesn't. These allegations mean something or they don't. I want proof, before anybody gets severely punished. I don't look at a potential $120 million golden parachute as particularly being punished. But there is allegedly an investigation going on by lawyers at CBS that will determine the size of Les Moonves's golden parachute. It'll probably take a couple of months. This is what they call the cooling off period. They want to find out if it's okay to pay him off. And once it's okay, if people forget, they'll try to quietly pay him off and make sure that it doesn't get... They'll announce the findings right before Thanksgiving or something. That's my prediction right now. Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the biggest bar night of the year, I suspect we'll find out the results of the internal investigation by CBS lawyers and the size of Les Moonves' golden parachute. And it will be buried in football and tryptophan the next day, because that's how it works. All right, I wouldn't call anything that goes on at CBS art, but art does exist. I paint occasionally, not particularly well, but I enjoy it. It's a nice relaxation. I haven't had time to do it for at least a year, but someday I hope to be able to do that again. I have the canvases. But the art world is pretty screwed up. I think we all agree with that. Well, there's this art exhibit. This story is insane. And this just shows how tacky and stupid the art world is. From the UK Daily Mail. An art installation where visitors are encouraged to have their photo taken next to an Islamic State terrorist waiting to behead them has been blasted by politicians. The artwork, which is part of an exhibit in the Gagbot Art and Music Festival in the eastern Dutch city of unpronounceable God knows what the Dutch do with these letters, features a full-size picture of ISIS terrorist Jihad John dressed entirely in black, printed on a wood board. Next to the ISIS executioner sits his victim dressed in an orange jumpsuit, down on his knees shortly before beheading. Now, you've all seen these things where the cutout for the head and you put your head into a picture and, hey, you're having lunch with Ronald McDonald or you're standing next to John Wayne or whatever. That's what this is. Somehow, some idiot thought this would be good. Now, Jihad John, for those of you who don't know, he was the British guy who was beheading prisoners, usually Westerners, a lot of times journalists, that ISIS had taken into custody. He gives his big spiel with his British accent and the mask over his face, and then he slowly saws off the person who was drugged, saws off their head. It is disgusting. It is the height of evil, and there is a special room in hell where he is being anally prodded for all time. What causes an artist to think, hey, I got an idea. You know that big art exhibit we got coming up? I'm going to go put a picture out there mocking these people who've been beheaded by members of the terrorists, ISIS. They call the work Phantom Pain, and it was created by a 22-year-old named Annie Bothmer, who argued that, quote, diving into crowds, bombing and shooting caused massive stream of irrational reactions. This liberal artist, of course, blames the West for the rise of terrorism and this piece of human garbage sawing off people's heads. May Annie one day meet such a lovely, lovely human being, and then, only then, can she fully understand just how damn stupid she is. But this is art, somehow. Speaking of art, the Serena Williams controversy. Now, again, I wasn't watching the U.S. Open. Didn't even know it was going on until it was over, until people started tweeting about this. I think it was on CBS, which is part of the problem because I don't watch CBS. Not because I don't watch CBS. It doesn't even occur to me to watch most broadcast networks. The only thing I watch on broadcast TV most of the time is American Ninja Warrior. But that stuff looks like fun. But Serena Williams had a little bit of a hissy fit. She was accused of getting coaching. She smashed her racket and broke her racket. Apparently, you can't get coaching during professional tennis matches, or at least at the U.S. Open. Her coach later admitted he was trying to coach her from the stands. If you look at the footage, there's kind of the yeah nod and the yeah nod back, like they knew that they were communicating, whatever it was. But the coach admitted he was trying to coach. So I'm not really sure what Serena Williams is all upset about. More importantly, Serena Williams got her ass handed to her. She got destroyed by the ultimate winner. But you don't even remember the ultimate winner's name, Naomi Osaka, because Serena Williams started berating the umpire, yelling at them, saying, you're never going to umpire another match I'm involved in, basically threatening this guy's career, a guy who makes $600 per match. She's getting millions of dollars, he's getting a few hundred dollars, and she's standing up telling him what for, and don't you dare, and don't you know who I am, essentially. Well, afterwards, the story was not about Osaka's win and defeating handily, just handing her ass to Serena Williams. The story was about Serena Williams and the umpire. The U.S. Tennis Association fined her $17,000 for her temper tantrum. And you would think most people would go, you should probably comport yourself better. You are a professional. You are the best in the world. Maybe you should comport yourself better. You had a bad day. Just accept it and move on. But no, the left has rallied to Serena Williams. Why? Because Serena Williams played the victim card. And the left, there is nothing liberals love more than a good victim. Real or not, it doesn't matter. In fact, not is even better because they can just make stuff up and fill in the blanks. At a press conference after the match, Serena Williams sat down and she played the victim card herself. We have the audio. Listen to this.
I can't sit here and say I wouldn't say he's a thief because I thought he took a game from me, but I've seen other men call other umpires several things, and I'm here fighting for women's rights and for women's equality and for all kinds of stuff, and for me to say thief and for him to take a game, it made me feel like it was a sexist remark. I mean, like, how he's never took a game from a man because they said thief.
See, there's a problem with that, though. He'd already taken the game from her before she called him a thief. Her timeline, in her own mind, I don't think she's lost it. I think she's trying to paint herself as more of a victim. You hear it there. I'm fighting for women's rights and blah, 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 blah. Oh, really? What are you doing? She'd complained to the point and berated him to the point and been caught being coached and smashed a racket, all of which is against the rules, that she'd already lost the game. He took the game from her. Then she called him a thief. So she's, well, if you want to be generous, she's wrong. She's misremembering. If you want to be less than generous, she's lying and painting herself as a victim. Now, the person, the real victim in all of this, aside from the umpire who was berated and now receiving threats because people are idiots, is the winner of the U.S. Open, Naomi Osaka. It's her big win, huge win on the world stage, and a massive fan of Serena Williams, and to have Serena Williams throw a temper tantrum that robs her of the spotlight, and now days later, we're still talking about Serena Williams. It's really, really pathetic. Serena, if you want to be a champion for women, maybe be quiet. Congratulate your opponent who resoundingly kicked your ass and just forget about it. You threw a temper tantrum. You threw a fit. I realize you've been a tennis star since you just finished puberty. You've been since you were a child. You were raised to be a tennis star, and you are an amazing tennis player. But you lost. You likely haven't heard the word no for a very long time, and you certainly haven't heard the word no from anybody who has the weight of no behind it, so I think your perspective is a little screwed up. You are not the victim here, Serena Williams. You, in fact, are the perp. Now, in this stupid controversy, political cartoonists did what political cartoonists do. They address this in their cartoons. And one guy named Mark Knight, with a K, he wrote he drew a political cartoon where in the foreground is Serena Williams, a caricature of Serena Williams, because all of these political cartoons are caricatures. That's, if they could draw really, really well, they'd probably be artists making exhibits where you can fake having your head cut off by a terrorist. And in the background, you have the umpire talking to Osaka saying, "Can't you just let her win?" Because of her temper tantrum. She's smashing the racket. There's a pacifier on the ground, so on and so forth. Well, the left seized on this and found another reason to rally around sweet, nourishing victim Serena Williams. They're calling this cartoon racist. J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter fame, another person who likely hasn't heard the word no in forever. That's the only reason to explain why they're making those Fantastic Beast movies. She tweeted, quote, "Well done on reducing one of the greatest sportswomen alive to racist and sexist tropes and turning a second-grade sportswoman into a faceless prop." See, now they're getting offended not just for Serena Williams, because she's ready to have them be offended on her behalf. They're getting offended on behalf of Naomi Osaka, too, because in the background, it looks like she's got blonde hair. And that is a no-no. People have way too much time on their hands. Somebody tweeted, "But why is the Haitian-Japanese opponent painted blonde?" Because it's in the background. You know, artists have a little bit of a license to play with light and whatever. And how about you just get over it? How pathetic does your existence have to be that you're offended by a political cartoon, calling it racist and sexist, and then going, wait, in the background through a jeweler's loop, "I think I see something else I can be offended in." The left really is a yo mama fight where they just try and one-up each other in stupid things to be offended about. That's where we are in 2018. That's how sick our society has gotten in 2018. 20 years ago, the world would have looked at Serena Williams' temper tantrum the way the world looked at John McEnroe's temper tantrums in the 80s and thought, stop being a prima donna. Stop being a spoiled brat. Play the damn game. You're making more than anybody sitting in the crowd to play this stupid game, and you're losing. You're mad because you're losing, and you're taking out your losing on somebody who has nothing to do with your losing. You're mad at yourself. Deal with it. But you can't say that. Can't say that anymore in 2018, because then you're some sort of ist or phobe or some other stupid term that the left will make up to further divide us. This is how sad and pathetic our world has become. Speaking of sad and pathetic, there's apparently... Now, she's referred to everywhere as a legendary Broadway star. I never heard of this old bag, but her name... Oh, yeah, I'm going to catch hell for the old bag comment. But when you're making this crack, when you make this comment, you deserve a hell of a lot worse. Her name is Carol Cook. Lord knows what she did. I imagine, you know, she said in reference to President Trump, quote, "Where's John Wilkes Booth when you need him?" Of course, John Wilkes Booth, an actor who murdered President Lincoln. Again, another Hollywood, Broadway, New York, coastal elitist making a death threat or a death wish against the President of the United States. Now, in Carol Cook's defense, judging by the photograph there, she may have worked with John Wilkes Booth, may have been in a relationship with John Wilkes Booth, but I've never heard of her. It's just another stunning example of how out of touch the left is in the United States of America. Finally today, quick note about Michael Moore, the communist, Jabba the Commie, as I affectionately call him, the mistake from Michigan. He has a new movie coming out that is going to get a lot of play. I'm not even going to name it because he doesn't need the publicity. He will get richer and fatter over all of it. For somebody who wants to spread the wealth around, he sure doesn't want to spread the buffet around. Well, his ex-wife is suing him because she claims in their divorce
agreement, she forewent all payments about the movies that they'd made together in the past for a slice of the profits of the movies he was going to make in the future. Now he's saying that he's not really making any money now, and he hasn't made a bunch of money, much money, a few, like $35,000 in the last couple of years, which is insane, which is a lie. Royalties, he's hiding the money. People have ways to hide their money. But when Michael Moore's hype machine really gets rolling, and MSNBC is going to have a town hall meeting with Michael Moore to help promote his movie, because they're a serious news organization. I believe Chris Hayes is going to host it on his program and with a live studio audience, because Chris Hayes is a hack and he's probably getting paid for it. If not, he should be. He's got a really bad agent if he's not getting paid for it. But one question that likely won't be asked of Michael Moore, because these questions are rarely asked of leftists because they generally only go and talk to other leftists, is how much money, Michael Moore, did you pay Bob and Harvey Weinstein to get their names off of this movie? Oh, yes. Michael Moore's new movie, make no mistake about it, was produced by the Weinstein brothers. Now, Michael Moore doesn't want you to know that. Some money had to have exchanged hands. They produced his first, his big hit, Fahrenheit 9/11. They produced a lot of his movies. They've made a lot of money together, the Weinsteins and the Moores. And according to Deadline Hollywood, the Weinstein brothers put up $2 million of the $6 million it cost to make Michael Moore's new ridiculous piece of Leni Riefenstahl porn. That is, for those of you playing the home game, a third. That would mean they are responsible for a third of it. That's a lot of money in a movie that'll probably make $50 to $100 million. That means the big return on that $2 million investment. The Weinsteins knew this. They could have stopped the release of the movie if Michael Moore refused to give them their credit and to give them their cut. So, a deal had to be struck. Somebody got paid. And by somebody, I mean the Weinsteins. How much were they paid? How much of that pervert's money did Michael Moore have to return on that investment? So he's not going to say, okay, here's your $2 million back and we'll just call it a day. We'll shake hands and part as friends. That ain't the way Hollywood works, and that sure as hell ain't the way the Weinsteins worked. So I wonder if any liberal journalists out there will bother to ask Michael Moore and demand answers and perhaps some proof, not just Michael Moore's aw shucks routine, to find out how much the Weinsteins made off of this new movie that he's going to be putting out soon. I doubt the question will be asked, but at least now it's planted in your head. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. If you still want to enter the signed book deal from me, I'm giving away two signed copies of my book, Outrage, Inc. Email Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. Or if you bought the book and you just want a signed book plate, you don't have to have me butcher your name if I pull it out of the drawing. You can email the same thing and just say, hey, I don't want your stinking book. I already got your stinking book. I just want a signed book plate, and send me your address, and I'll send you the book plate. Or if you want the real deal, whatever, I will announce now. And I'm probably going to jinx myself. But I'm going to knock on wood. This coffee table better be wood. Next week on the program, on the Friday version of the program, we're scheduled, as of now, to have Ken Starr, which I'm very excited about. He's got a new book out, and I've got a lot of questions. I was in college during the Clinton scandals that he investigated. And boy, howdy, that's going to be a really fun interview, because I've never met him. But here's a little bit of trivia. It's not trivia. It's a little anecdote. My first week in Washington, D.C., when I was working at the Heritage Foundation, I started off in the bookstore. And I came back from lunch one day. I was on the fourth floor. It wasn't really a bookstore. It was more people would call in and have to send them stuff. And I get off the elevator, and right there is Ed Meese talking to Ken Starr outside of my office. And I'm like, holy crap. And I walk past, and I'm eyeballing them, but I can't just total fanboy or anything. But the door was glass to the bookstore, and I sat there kind of peeking out, pushing my face against it, watching these two guys that, you know, were famous talk in the hallway on the fourth floor of the Heritage Foundation. And I thought, what can I do? I called my parents, and they weren't nearly as excited as I was. But that was the closest I ever came to meeting Ken Starr. Hopefully next week I will finish the job and get to meet Ken Starr. Very much looking forward to that. The only problem I have is I can't find a copy of the Starr Report in hardcover. Apparently it's like $500 on Amazon, which I'm not going to pay, and I don't really collect soft cover signed books, so I have a couple of his other books that I'll get signed. I'm going to try to get a couple of copies of his book from the publisher that we can hopefully give away, but I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't know his publisher, and I don't know how to communicate with them very well, but hopefully that will work out. Just keep your fingers crossed. And by the way, this is the 17th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th. I suggest you take a moment to remember what happened that day. One thing that has faded over time, but when I watch the footage of it, it comes back to me like it was today, was the anger I felt. I was working in Washington, D.C., but I was living in Baltimore at the time. And there was an ebook conference. I was still in the publishing department of the Heritage Foundation at the time because I just moved out in June of 2001. And I hadn't moved into domestic policy or started doing health policy yet. And I'm sitting there the day before, and I find out that a couple of guys from the department are going to an ebook conference. Ebooks were very new in 2001. And they were going to an ebook conference in downtown Baltimore. And all I thought was, hey, there's an opportunity for me not to have to ride the train into D.C. I can stay in Baltimore and go to this stupid ebook conference. And I just use it as an excuse to not have to go to work that day. So my boss, who was very lax at the time, said, sure, yeah, go ahead, whatever. So I go down there. It starts at about 8. And right around 9, maybe 9:15, somebody comes in and whispers to the guy who's talking about whatever. I wasn't listening. I honestly wasn't listening to any of it. Whispers to the guy something about an attack in New York, plane crash, something. Now, I'd been a news junkie forever. The two guys that were there from work, Mark and Harris, they were actually very interested in it. They lived for this stuff. That was their goal, to do this stuff. I didn't have any interest in it. I was just looking for a foot in the door at the Heritage Foundation. So I immediately got up and I went to the lobby of the hotel because I wanted to know what the hell was going on. And I saw the towers on fire and started watching the news. A couple of minutes later, they adjourned. They took a break early for the conference. Come out, everybody floods into the lobby of the hotel and they're watching this happen. And then after about 10 minutes, they said, all right, let's go back in, go back inside. Let's get this show back on the road. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking at my friends like, F, no, I'm not going back in there. Like, I'm going home. We're only about a mile from my apartment. Like, I'm going home. You guys go back in there. Have a good time. I have to know what's going on. I hop in a cab, get home. We're listening to it on the radio, this guy, the cab driver. It takes me back home. I watch it. I remember watching the towers fall. I remember thinking at the hotel, like, that one looks like it's leaning. It was weird. But I watched the towers fall, and this anger came over me. And then you hear the stories about what's going on in the Pentagon. You hear the stories. There were all kinds of stories that day. There was a bomb on the Washington Monument which had been taken down. There was a bomb at the State Department. The chaos in that moment. And I wanted to get to D.C. I had an overwhelming desire to go to D.C. Like, there was something I could do. There was nothing I could have done. But I had that feeling, that sense of rage. And it's faded over time, but it comes back at this time of year. Those sons of bitches, they're rotting in hell. And the ones that aren't yet soon will be. And we have to keep a focus on that. And not the politically correct crap that we see now. We took the just war that we were fighting, the righteous war, and we turned it over to politicians who turned it into Vietnam. And rather than trying to win a war against evil, they started trying to win hearts and minds and rebuild countries and make sure everybody loved us. I don't care if they love us or they hate us. I want them to not kill people. I don't want them to kill Americans. If these terrorists want to kill each other, if two terrorist factions want to go to war, knock yourself out. Do it over in the hellholes of Afghanistan, in the mountains, and kill each other completely. But if you're going to come after us, we have to come after you like rabid spider monkeys. We have to go after you not to arrest you, but to kill you, whether it's painful or not, whether liberals clutch their pearls and call it inhumane or not. We have to make sure that these people are no longer polluting our air with their existence. And we lose sight of that and all the crap that has come since then. And it's sad and it's pathetic, and that makes me angry all over again. Anyway, that is the show for today, really. There, I just slapped on like 7 more minutes or whatever it was at the end of the program. I'm Derek Hunter. I appreciate you listening. Tell a friend and come back tomorrow for another exciting edition.